here and now, and here is where my war was. Gearhart came back. Brunner, kissing as usual, got up from a box he was sitting on so Gearhart could sit on it. Gearhart sat on it. I didn't think Lieutenant Carroll would have done that.
The Vietnamese officer, Colonel Hai, has changed his mind, Gearhart said. Now he wants his men to take the hill.
We was on the damn hill already, Pee-wee said.
That's why Stuart is pissed, Gearhart said. After we reach the hill without drawing fire, Hai thinks it's safe, so he'll send his men up, then he'll write up his report and take credit for the body count.
What do we do, stay here?
No. We follow them back up the hill,
Gearhart said.
The ARVNs had an ONTOS, an anti-tank weapon that was supposed to lead the way. But there was no way the tracked vehicle was going to get through the mud. And if it did get to the base of the hill, there was no way it was going up the hill through the trees unless somebody chopped out a path for it. At least we didn't have to do that. The ARVNs got into a staging area and started moving out. We sat and watched as what looked like almost a full company of little soldiers moved out. They were bunched too tightly and they were moving too quickly. They left a small headquarters contingent behind as they moved out. Charlie Company moved out after the tail end of the ARVNs, which were mostly mortar teams. We followed Charlie Company. It was 13:20 hours. The first fire came from the flank. Two squads of ARVNs moved out to suppress it.
I don't like it, Dungan said. That's about where we were on the first trip. I bet you got the second over there.
He was talking about the 2nd North Vietnamese Regiment. I had heard about them. They had been operating in Quang Ngai and just southeast of Tam Kỳ, but the Marines had beaten them pretty badly. If it was the 2nd Regulars, they would be more disciplined and better armed than the VCs. The flank fire seemed to move the whole battalion toward it and toward the paddies. I didn't want to go through the paddies again.
Incoming!
Monaco yelled, and we hit the ground. The mortar shells landed behind us. They were long again. Long, but walking. They had spotters who saw where the shells were landing and who were directing the fire. They kept shortening up the range to get closer and closer to us, and the shells were coming fast. The noise was terrible. Every time a mortar went off, I jumped. I couldn't help myself. The noise went into you. It touched parts of you that were small and frightened and wanting your mommy. Being away from the fighting had weakened my stamina. It did even more to my nerves. I was shaking. I had to force myself to keep my eyes open. The South Vietnamese ahead of us had just cleared the paddies when the whole damn hill seemed to explode with gunfire. I was 30 meters into the paddies. The shells exploding in the paddies sent water in huge cones into the air. The ARVNs on the far edge of the paddy, and those who were trapped in the open space between the paddy and the hill's woodline, were being cut down in waves. Some started to come back into the paddy. Others in the paddy were trying to get out to dash across the open space to the woodline.
Get back! Get back!
Gearhart had turned around and crouched over, one hand holding his helmet. We started moving back. The ARVNs around us didn't seem to know what to do. I didn't know what to do either. I slipped in the mud and went straight down. I tried to hold my piece out of the water, but I wasn't sure if I did or not. Then there was fire from our rear. We were trapped in the paddy. I was on my knees, water up to my waist.
Stay away from the dikes and work back toward the staging area,
Gearhart called out. Suddenly, there were jets in the skies above us. I watched one as it dove toward the hill and pulled up just after releasing a bomb. I turned to see the napalm explode and then roll up the hill in a billowing cloud. An ARVN soldier was struggling to keep moving. He had been hit, and the water around him was red with blood. I put my arm under his and lifted him the best I could. Monaco grabbed him by the other side, and we dragged him along.
Keep going! Keep going!
Lieutenant Gerhardt's voice. We reached the wood line and laid the ARVN guy down. A medic came over, looked at him, and pulled him into a sheltered space.
Hit that line!
It was Pee-wee's voice.
Johnson, hit that line!
I turned to see what he was pointing at.
There was a row of bushes that almost completely hid the muzzle flashes coming from their midst. Johnson got down in a prone position and started stitching the bushes. We all went down and started firing. There were Kongs on the hill behind us and Kongs to our flanks. We kept moving toward the line of bushes, and I saw some of them moving out. Johnson cut them down as they ran. There were stands of trees every 100 yards or so along the rice paddies leading to the hill. We hit the first stand and fought from tree to tree. I got behind a tree and took clips from my belt. They were wet, and I shook them and blew on them to get the water off. There were hundreds of ARVNs still in the paddies. They were being cut up pretty bad. Many were wounded and screaming. Some of the ARVNs had just stopped where they were and were holding their hands to their heads. They had freaked out completely. Some guys from Charlie Company had tried to get out along the dikes and now lay dead on them. One kept waving his arm in the air. He was still alive. Another guy from Charlie Company started out after him. I turned away and started firing at the wood line.
Move it out! Move it out! We'll get pinned here!
Get pinned? Shit, we were pinned. The wood line was alive with Kongs, but we kept moving toward them. The jet above saw what was going on and came down and raked the wood line. He dropped a bomb that shook the ground. I flinched as the heat from it came over me like a rush. Gerhardt was screaming something. I got up and started moving toward the wood line again. There were 50, maybe 60 meters to the next stand of trees. When I got to it, I went down and pushed along on my belly. I saw Lobo pushing along a few meters from me. The flak jacket caught on everything. I couldn't move with it. I took it off. I felt 100 pounds lighter. We pushed through the wood line until we reached a clearing. The firing stopped. For a few seconds, there was absolute silence. And then everything started up again as heavily as it had been. It was as if somebody had changed channels and then switched back to the war. From the paddies, I could hear the screaming of wounded men, mostly Vietnamese. They cried out in high-pitched voices that sounded almost like cats wailing. We were under cover and held our position. Gerhardt was running by, saw Johnson, and ran to him. He didn't say anything. He just collapsed near him. I saw him feel his chest, and I thought he might have been wounded. Then I saw him pull out a cigarette. His hands were shaking too badly to light the cigarette, and Johnson took it and lit it for him. Gerhardt took a deep draw on the cigarette, then seemed to pull himself together. I looked around for Pee-wee and saw him and Monaco together. They had got another 60 from somewhere and were firing it across the clearing. I looked for the soldier from Charlie Company who had been waving his arm at the dike. I saw him, just his shoulders and an outstretched arm out of the water. Captain Stewart was coming over toward us. Beyond him, I saw guys moving out across the open space. We were getting the hell away from the hill, but I didn't know where we were going. Stewart had blood on his face, but I couldn't see if he was hit or not. Gerhardt waved me over. He told me to keep an eye on Jamal. I said I would.
This is too hot for a dust-off area, Stewart was saying to Gerhardt. There's a little village down this road. The VC must have it, but their main force is on the hill. The squad the ARVNs chased went back to the mountain.
That the second?
I guess so, Stewart said. But we can't sit out here. We need to get to the village and get picked up from there. We can't hold these positions much longer.
Stewart told Charlie Company to move out first, but when he saw what was left of it, he had us all move out together. Jamal had hurt his hand, maybe even broken it, but he was okay except for being winded.
We went on a forced march for 10 minutes toward the village. We knew when we reached it as the first men started to fall. The ARVN troops, still not reorganized, caught up with us as we formed a perimeter and tried to get into the village. Some of them ran past us. We watched them get hit and start running back. I was afraid they would start firing on us. Then I saw that many of them had even dropped their weapons. I saw the area that Captain Stewart had been talking about. It would make an iffy dust-off area at best. Choppers could get in and out fairly quickly, but it would be easy for the Kong guns on the hill to hit. Maybe our artillery could keep them quiet. But there was no way the choppers could move in if we didn't take the village. Colonel High finally got what was left of his outfit together and attacked the village. They went on what looked like a suicide charge into the village. As they ran, they began to fall. They fell according to how they were hit. If they were hit in the head, they went backward or whirled around. Sometimes a man hit in the head would go several more stumbling steps before falling. If they were hit in the body, they would just lean forward, as if they were reaching for the ground, and then collapse.
Let's go!
We moved out. Johnson and Monica were behind us, covering us with the 60. They had given the other 60 to an ARVN squad. We ran forward, desperately searching for something to get behind as the bullets whined about us, kicking up dirt and snapping branches. A fresh company of ARVNs had swung around the flank. We were closing in on the village. I was on the ground. I was hurting. My arms and shoulders ached. I loaded another clip and started firing. It was a hamlet, the same thatched roofs, the same smell of burnt bamboo. We fired into the village, trying to chop down anything we could see. Johnson moved the 60 up and got it into place. Monaco loaded again. It was time for the rest of us to get up, to charge again. I was tired. So tired. There was nothing to do but to go on. It came to me that we had the hamlet surrounded, so there was nothing for the Kongs to do but to defend the village. We were here, and they were here. And the only thing to take care of was the dying. I ran on. I saw Pee-wee throwing a grenade. A good idea. I snatched a grenade from my belt and threw it through the window of a hut. Shit. I had forgotten to take the damn pin out. I started firing through the window when I saw the grenade come out. I jumped away, twisting my body as I saw it bounce. It bounced toward me. My hands went up. I tried to turn my chest away. I didn't want to see it, but I couldn't turn away. I looked. It still wasn't armed. I grabbed it and pulled the pin out, arming it. I threw it again. It went through the same window. This time, it exploded. I was on my feet, running toward the hut, firing at nothing, at everything. So tired. I couldn't get my arms up. We went from hut to hut. I wanted to rest, just for a moment. I saw two ARVNs and a GI go into a hut, their pieces ready. Another GI was outside. He tossed a grenade through the window. The explosion ripped away a side of the hut. It happened in an instant, a split moment of pain and confusion. A guy had just nailed the two ARVNs and the GI who had walked in the door of the hut. In another instant, I swung my rifle toward the soldier who had thrown the grenade. He turned right and moved toward another hut as I lowered my weapon and turned left. A cart, one wheel blasted off, sat in front of a low building that could have been made out of concrete. A soldier sat on the ground, leaning against the wheel. There was an irregular circle of blood spreading over his t-shirt. He seemed to be trying to wipe it away with his hand. We reached the far end of the hamlet. Monaco was in front when we reached the last hut. I caught up with him. Johnson was lugging the 60. We flattened ourselves against the sides of the hut, and then Johnson peppered one side of it with the 60. Monaco took out a cigarette lighter and lit the roof. Damn. Pee-wee. I spun around and looked. Pee-wee was at the far end of the hut toward the wood line trying to get his 16 to work. It had jammed. Me and Monaco went around the side of the hut and saw two Kong soldiers trying to pull an American into the bushes. Even when we started firing, they kept pulling him. We went after them. Monaco shot one of them, and the other stood up and threw his arms into the air. At his feet, the soldier, still alive, was moaning in pain. I looked and saw that they had cut his finger off. I looked up into the face of the Kong soldier. He was young, no more than a teenager. He looked scared and tired, the same as me. I squeezed the trigger of the 16 and watched him hurtle backward. Then I sat down on the ground to rest.
"Let's go! Let's go! Get the perimeter!"
Lieutenant Gerhardt.
"We need a medic,"
Pee-wee said, pointing to the wounded soldier.
"Okay. The medevac's on its way."
Somehow I managed to get up. Gerhardt went around trying to place guys on the perimeter. It was too much effort to talk. My lips were dry and I was getting cold. I looked over at Monaco. He was sweating. We waited. It was 1342. I couldn't believe that so little time had passed. The ARVNs set up a perimeter, and we were told that we could rest. Gerhardt said that Sergeant Dongan had been hit. Me and Pee-wee went over to the medical tent. We found Dongan. They had laid his leg next to him. The other leg was barely attached. But it didn't matter now. His mouth was slightly open and the lower jaw twisted.
"One of you guys got a poncho?"
A Black Spec 5 asked. I looked to see if I still had my poncho. I did and gave it to the Spec 5. He picked up the leg and put it on Sergeant Dongan's chest, then wrapped him in the poncho. 10 minutes later, two gunships came in and cleared everything from around the village. Above them, I could see the stack of medevac choppers. It was 1400 hours. Chapter 19. The ARVNs were the first to start to move out. Word had come that a second North Vietnamese battalion was moving toward the area. We had to get out, and get out quickly. We made as many litters as we could to carry out the wounded. The question came up as to what to do with the dead. Somebody said we should bury them.
"They'll just dig them up," Gerhardt said. "We gotta strip them and burn them."
Hell. Bodies still warm. Limbs that fell as the bodies were moved. Some guys couldn't do it. Some of us had to. We began stripping the Americans. We took their tags, their gear, and took them to a hut.
How many were there?
There were too many. Everybody took care of their own. We got Dongan and put him in the hut. Some of the bodies were wrapped in ponchos. Some weren't. Guys from Charlie Company saw what we were doing and they got their people in. It was better than having the Kongs get them. Maybe mutilating the bodies.
"Make sure you get all the tags,"
Gerhardt was saying. I was afraid of the dead guys. I saw them, arms limp, faces sometimes twisted in anguish, mostly calm. And I was afraid of them. They were me. We wore the same uniform, were the same height, had the same face. They were me. And they were dead. No one looked into the faces, into the often still open eyes. We did what we had to do and turned away. The ARVNs, who hadn't already left, watched us impassively. They didn't want any part of what we were doing. They left their dead where they were. They stripped them, took the ammo and the supplies. They closed their eyes.
"This guy's still alive, man."
Monica was looking at a guy in the middle of a pile. The poncho he had been wrapped in came away from his face. He was unconscious, but he was still breathing. Two guys from Charlie Company who recognized him ran over and started pushing the bodies off him. I watched as the limbs flew off the pile until they reached the guy who was still alive. When they uncovered his body, I could see bubbles of blood coming from a gaping wound in his throat. The flies around the pile, crawling over the bodies, into and out of the wound, buzzed in delight.
"Somebody get a medic!
Jamal!"
Jamal was outside and Monaco got him. Jamal looked at the guy and shook his head. The front of the guy's flak jacket was dark with either sweat or blood. When the sweat mixed with the mud, it was hard to tell. Jamal opened it and saw another wound. The flesh was burned and puffed away from a wound big enough to put a fist into. I looked back at the throat wound. The bubble of blood still rose and fell rhythmically. How was he still alive?
"Do something for him!"
The guy from Charlie Company's voice was menacing. "He's your friend?" Jamal asked.
"Yeah, he's my friend,"
the guy from Charlie Company said. "Then you do it," Jamal said. He stood and walked away. A couple of us stood and walked out behind Jamal. A moment later, we heard the shot. We went back in and piled the bodies back up on the guy. They got a flamethrower, and we moved away from the hut. The smell of burning flesh came quickly. I knew the smell wouldn't leave me quickly. Maybe it never would. We started off. I didn't want to look back. I did. The hut was burning furiously.
"Who's got the tags?"
Gerhardt asked Wallowick. Wallowick turned and looked at him. His lips were swollen. One side of his face was puffed. There was blood in the corner of his mouth. He didn't answer Gerhardt. A guy from Charlie Company pointed to another guy from Charlie Company who was supposed to have the tags, and Gerhardt went over to him. Then he came back.
"He forgot the tags," Gerhardt said. "He left them in the hut."
"How are they gonna let their folks know they dead?"
Pee-wee said. Gerhardt didn't answer.
What would they do for a body? Would they send home an empty coffin? Would they scrounge pieces from graves registration? What would they say to their parents, their wives? "We lost your son, ma'am. Somewhere in the forests he lies, perhaps behind some rock, some tree. We burned his body, ma'am. In a rite hurried by fear and panic, we burned what was left of him and ran for our own lives. Yes, and we're sorry." Perhaps they would tell them nothing, not having a body in hand, not having the lifeless form to send with the flag. They would not acknowledge that there was a death at all. "Yes, and we're sorry." The ARVNs were up ahead of us, pushing through the woods. They were moving quickly. I looked for Pee-wee and found him. He was behind Gerhardt. Gerhardt had his head up. His flak jacket was open. We went quickly, stumbling, but somehow in control of ourselves. We were looking out for each other, checking each other out. I stayed with Jamal, mostly. I asked how he was doing.
"I don't believe I'm not dead," he said. "You know I'm not made for this kind of life."
The ARVNs were headed for the same pickup zone we were. They cut down along the edge of the paddies, and we took a longer route through the wood line. The branches ripped at us. Vines caught our feet. It was like a nightmare. The forest itself was our enemy, trying to catch us, trying to hold us in its grip. Small arms fire. The ARVNs were under fire. We dove for cover.
"Get up! Get up! Keep moving!"
The voice came from behind us. I saw Captain Stewart look back to see who was talking. I turned. It was Johnson.
"Stay down!" Captain Stewart barked out his order. "Look for the sniper!"
"Let's move it!"
Johnson started forward.
"I said stay down, damn it!"
Stewart yelled. I was on my feet. Monaco was up. We were moving again, following Johnson. The hell with Stewart. We broke through the underbrush. We kept moving. I looked around. Stewart was coming too. Suddenly, I wasn't there. It was as if I were out of my body and looking down at us. And then I was back. What the hell was going on? I shook my head. Everything seemed okay again. We kept moving. I hoped like hell that somebody knew where we were going. Monica was up ahead. He held his hand up, and we dropped where we were. I could feel my heart beating in my temples. I was gasping for air, sucking in tiny fleets of flying bugs, spitting them out, sucking in another fleet. Movement to my right. We were moving again. Pee-wee was trying to get Jamal up. I went over to them. He hit? No, Pee-wee said. Jamal was shaking. Tears were running down his face. He was ugly. God, a man could be ugly when he cried. Pee-wee punched him in the face and started pulling him up. I got his other arm and started pulling him up. Gearhart was over. He jerked Jamal by the collar.
Move it, soldier!
He spat the words in Jamal's face. Jamal was moving again. He was okay. He was one of us again. Suddenly, I wasn't there. There was somebody running in my boots, but it wasn't me. The legs moved mechanically. The weapon stayed in front of the body. I could almost see myself running. I could feel myself running, but it wasn't me running. What the hell was going on? I stopped.
Move it, Perry!
Gearhart's voice. The ground was passing me faster, but it wasn't me running. It was someone else, perhaps even something else. It was a body moving through a nightmare. A nightmare in which everything knew everything. Where the ground pushed your feet away and the vines clutched at your legs while the trees chortled and shook with silent laughter. We stopped. The sweat was cold against my body. Up ahead, Monica was sitting with his back to a tree. His chest was heaving. He gave hand signals. Gearhart moved up. Johnson moved up. Where did they get the strength? I looked at Pee-wee. Pee-wee, my main man. Pee-wee's face was dark. There were shadows where his eyes should have been. The shadows moved. Pee-wee moved. He was getting up. I didn't want to get up. I wanted to sit there forever. Where the hell was the popcorn machine? Couldn't I just watch the rest of this damn war? Couldn't I just be out of it for a few hours, a few minutes? We moved up. There were voices, Vietnamese. We moved up. The soft pop-pops of the grenade launchers went off. There was screaming, high-pitched whines that died slowly as the life drained from the body. We pushed up. There was a clearing and nearly a platoon of NVAs. We had them in the open. I couldn't believe it. We fired as they started scrambling away. Suddenly, I wasn't there. There was a sight in front of me, and I stared at bodies trying to move across an open field. There was the sensation of vibration in my hands, against my face, and the distant sound of an M16 firing. I felt a shoulder moving, perhaps mine, reversing clips I had taped together. There were soldiers trying to move away from the forward sights of a 16. They weren't moving nearly fast enough.
Get the perimeter, Captain Stewart again. You two men get to the other side of this clearing. The 60 will cover you. Never happened.
Pee-wee dug in.
Soldier!
Captain Stewart swung a .45 on Pee-wee. I didn't see the 60 move. I heard the impact of the bullets in the ground in front of Captain Stewart's feet. I saw him leap backward. I saw him dive for cover. The .45 went back into its case. I looked over my shoulder. Johnson was on his knees, a menacing silhouette. The 60 swung toward the clearing and raked the far side. Suddenly, a figure popped out of the underbrush carrying a tube.
Get him! Get him!
The 60 barked. The figure started at first to collapse and then to expand. It was as if it drew in on itself, gathered the momentum it needed, and then began to grow. The arms flung apart, but it had already fired the RPG.
Down,
Sweet Jesus, please.
Dirt all over me. There was more firing. I looked up. There was something near me. It was flesh. I pushed it away. I wanted to get away from it. I stood and started to run from it. The ARVNs were on the left. I saw them. I fired in their direction. I don't know why. I stopped and tried to pull myself together. The Charlies were still ahead of us. They had backed themselves into a tight knot in the middle of the field. There must have been 60, maybe 70 of them. We fired at them and fired at them and fired at them. Bodies once alive, then lifeless, seemed to live again as the bullets tore into the dead flesh and made it dance in the afternoon sun. I breathed in some bugs without bothering to spit them out.
Cease fire! Cease fire!
Gerhard. The other side of the clearing was burning. The sudden darkness of a jet surprised me. Surprised all of us. One guy opened up. The jet roared and dropped a bomb just over the clearing. Napalm. It burst into the trees, rolling, rushing, a gale of fire through the trees. Couldn't breathe. I went down. Guys were dropping around me as the heat from the napalm sucked up the air. The trees above us caught fire. My skin was full of tiny pinpricks. The napalm was too close. We started moving into the clearing. A Kong, maybe the one who had fired the RPG, was lying on top of a pile of bodies. His chest and stomach were open. There were tubes and organs and the redness of working parts that no longer worked.
Perry!
It was Pee-wee.
What?
He pointed. I looked. It was a soldier. He had been white, round-faced. Now the bottom of one leg was off. Most of the flesh from the thigh was off, too. The white, twisted bone angled out oddly from the hip. His eyes were open. His mouth was open as wide as it would go, the teeth bared.
Look at his hands, man.
The hands were around the neck of an NVA soldier. There were no other wounds on the NVA. The GI had killed him from the other side of death. I walked away. People were not supposed to be made like that. People were not supposed to be twisted bone in tubes that popped out at crazy kids' toys' angles. People were supposed to be sitting and talking and doing. Yes, doing. Chapter 20. When the ARV and troops first reached us, we didn't notice anything unusual. Then we heard one of their officers yelling and motioning for us to move back toward the hamlet.
What the hell is this?
Pee-wee reached for his rifle. Gerhard saw that the ARVN troops were surrounding us.
I almost freaked out. I thought the ARVN troops must have been Kongs in disguise.
What the fuck is this all about?
Gerhard was asking. Then we saw. The chopper started down. The ARVN officer simply wanted to get out first.
Put your hands up! Put your hands up!
Gerhard shouted. He threw down his weapon and put his hands high over his head. Pee-wee lifted the muzzle of his rifle.
No! Put your hands up high!
Gerhard shouted.
Like this!
He put his hands up even higher. We finally figured out what Gerhard had in mind and put our hands up. He was letting the guys in the choppers know what was up. The door gunners on the choppers opened up on the knot of ARVNs behind us. We got our pieces and started firing into them. They broke it off quickly and moved away. We started scrambling to the choppers, fighting off any ARVNs that tried to get on before us. The chopper I was trying to get on dipped down and almost knocked me off. Then it seemed to leap into the air with me hanging on to one side. Somebody pulled me in. I felt something slip by me, clutch at my ass, my leg, hold on to my ankle for a long second, and then let it go. I thought my ankle was broken. I twisted to see who was behind me. There was nobody. Nothing but the empty space of the door. Somebody had fallen out. It was forever getting back to the base. We were jumbled over each other, our bodies aching and too tired to move. We got to the base and somebody came up with some coffee. I had never been a coffee drinker in the world, but now I wanted it. Now I needed it, anything that promised to get me to the next minute. Gerhard told us to get some rest.
Sleep, he said.
Sleep. Rest. The words had lost their meaning. Trying to reach sleep, any kind of real sleep, was hard. It was as if I just faded out sometimes and then faded back in when we got called. Most of it wasn't rest either. You had to be away from the boonies for 3, maybe 4 days before you felt rested. It wasn't so much the running around or the fighting. It was the tension. Monaco's screaming woke me with a start. I jumped up, reaching for my rifle.
There they are! There they are!
He was screaming. He fell to the floor and shot a burst toward the door of the hooch.
Cease fire! Cease fire!
Wallowick was yelling. Lobel and Johnson jumped on Monaco and wrestled his weapon away from him. I was behind my bunk, looking toward the door.
Be cool! Be cool!
Johnson called out.
Oh, God!
Monaco had his hands to his head. They were helping him up.
What the fuck is going on?
I looked toward Pee-wee, who was standing flat against the wall.
I swore I thought I saw some Kongs dragging a guy through the bushes, Monaco said. I saw it just as plain as anything.
You were probably dreaming, I said, getting up from the floor.
No, man, I was awake,
Monaco said.
I saw these two Kongs dragging a guy into the bushes.
Monaco shook his head and sat down on his bunk. Everybody else cooled out. Some guys from another squad came over to find out what the shooting was about, and Wallowick told them a guy was working on his rifle and it went off. When they saw that Monaco was okay, Lobel and Brunner walked him over to the mess tent to get some coffee.
Hey, Perry,
Wallowick said on the edge of the bunk.
What? You know what happened to Monaco?
No. What?
I mean, you know what he just did? Thought he was seeing something he had seen before?
Yeah.
That happened to me once, he said. I was on guard and some VC tried to get through the barbed wire. We were firing on them. And out of the corner of my eye, I saw one that had already got through. He came at me and I turned and got him. And then I went back to firing on the other guys trying to get through. We stopped them. I didn't think much of it. But the next day I was playing volleyball and just as I turned.
Wallowick paused as if he were trying to remember exactly what had happened.
You thought you saw guys coming through the wire again? No. Not coming through the wire, he said. I thought I saw the guy that had broken through. I screamed and dove for the ground. It was pretty embarrassing.
It's understandable, though.
You understand it?
No. Monaco was cool by the next day. He made a lot of jokes about what had happened, but I thought he was worried about it. It was a dreary Friday. The rain beat down on the tin roof of the hooch all morning, and we were all down. Jamar was typing up a report on Brew and noticed it was his birthday. If Brew had made it, he would have been 19 on the 26th.
We could have had a birthday party for the guy, Pee-wee said.
He was cleaning his gear. I had been trying to get the mud from my boots, gave it up, and went to the mess tent. I asked the cook if he had any cake or anything, and he came up with some pound cake and some fruit cocktail. I took it back to the hooch. and we celebrated Bru's birthday.
Gerhard wrote 3 letters to his wife. He gave 1 to me, 1 to Wallowick, and he kept 1.
Gerhard said that if we got back to some place, we could mail the letters to go on and mail it. The letters were all the same, he said, more or less.
Just in case I don't get a chance to mail it myself, he said. You know.
Nobody answered him. He nodded and left.
Who the hell is he to lay this shit on us? Lobo asked. He seemed really mad.
Pee-wee told Wallowick to open the letter.
That's not right, Wallowick said. I didn't say the shit was right, Pee-wee said. I just said open a damn letter.
Wallowick opened it, and Lobo read it.
Dear Sandra, I have finally made a decision on the storm doors. I think we should go on and have the glass panel doors the way you want. We'll put my den in that room, and I'll put a good strong door that we can lock between that and the hallway leading to the bedrooms. That way, it'll be safe even if someone does try to break in, and you can still have the doors the way you want them. I don't know what you should do about the paper boy. If he insists upon being a wise guy, tell him not to deliver the damn paper anymore. The only reason to get the paper from him is to have something to read while you're having breakfast. Tell the kids I said hello. You're always better with words than me. Could you please tell them how much I love them? Try to explain that I love them as much as I love you, and you know how much that is. Things are going okay over here. I'm with some okay guys. Love, Ricky.
I wished I had a wife and kids. I really wished I had a wife and kids. Somebody somewhere that loved me in a way I could look forward to going back to the world to. I knew Mama loved me. But I also knew when I got back she would expect me to be the same person. But it could never happen. She hadn't been to Nam. She hadn't given her poncho to anybody to wrap a body in, or stepped over a dying kid. Maybe she was worried about me the same way a wife would. I didn't even know how a wife would worry. Gerhard wasn't talking about her worrying. He was just talking about the paper boy. It was like she was away and going through the crap. Maybe she was, in a way.
Pee-wee! I called over to where he was reading a paper. You think I should tell my little brother about how things are over here?
You ain't told him yet?
I keep trying to, but I can't get it out right. You know, I don't want him to think about it like you do when you go to the movies.
You gotta tell him it's just the way things are in the movies,
Lobo called out from across the aisle.
You tell people what this is really like, and who's going to come to the next war? They'll have all the announcements out and everything, and nobody will show up.
Yeah, but you know what I'm thinking? I'm thinking that whatever I tell him, he's going to start thinking about heroes and stuff like that.
Heroes?
You know, to a kid, if you kill somebody and the somebody is supposed to be a bad guy, you're a hero.
You ain't killed nobody yet, Pee-wee said. They got to be people before you can kill them. You think these Kongs is people?
Yeah, sure they are.
What they names?
How the hell would I know their names?
What they like to eat?
I don't know.
See, they ain't people to you yet. You figure out all that shit, what they names is, what they like to eat, who do the dishes and shit like that, then they people. Then you shoot them, you killing somebody.
You're talking technical stuff, Lobo said. You shoot some guy and he falls down, you've killed him, pure and simple.
Hey, Lobo. If they was people to your ugly overweight ass, you couldn't kill them because you wouldn't have the heart.
You couldn't either, I said.
Yeah, I could, Pee-wee said. I'm a damn animal, man. Oh, Pee-wee is going to fight the next war all by himself.
Monica was putting powder on his crotch.
No, I'm going to go out, get me some more 17-year-olds like us that don't know nothing, and turn them all into animals.
Pee-wee said.
And if I catch some dude putting face powder on his crotch like you doing, I'm gonna put him on point, cause I know he ain't got no sense.
This is supposed to keep the jock itch down, Monaco said.
They argued about whether or not Monaco was enough of a jock to have jock itch, with Pee-wee saying that Monaco was just about enough man to have jock tickle, but not near enough man to have jock itch. I started writing to Kenny. I just told him that the war was about us killing people and about people killing us, and I couldn't see much more to it. Maybe there were times when it was right. I had thought that this war was right, but it was only right from a distance. Maybe when we all got back to the world and everybody thought we were heroes for winning it, then it would seem right from there. Or maybe if I made it back and I got old, I would think back on it and it would seem right from there. But when the killing started, there was no right or wrong except in the way you did your job, except in the way that you were part of the killing. What you thought about, what filled you up more than anything, was the being scared and hearing your heart thumping in your temples and all the noises, the terrible noises, the screeches and the booms and the guys crying for their mothers or for their wives. And exciting. It was exciting, too. Sometimes, when we were waiting to make a move, to go into some area where we hadn't been before, it was as if the time would never come soon enough. That's what kept it going somehow. That and the idea that we were better than the Kongs. It was that, the knowing that we would win, and the excitement that overcame the being scared. If we just did our job, we would be all right. But I didn't think it was going to last forever. I was growing too tired. It was good that we were only in Nam for a year.
Y'all children can relax now, Pee-wee said as he stood in the doorway to the hooch. This war only gonna last about 3 more days. We got us a body count of 433 Kongs in the last fight.
433?
Johnson looked up to see if Pee-wee was kidding.
Yeah. Every time we shoot one of them, his cousin and his uncle die too,
Pee-wee said. Wallowick and Monaco made jokes about the body count, but they ended when Captain Stewart told us that afternoon that we were going out again.
This area is secure, Captain Stewart was saying. So they're moving the first cav up to the DMZ, and we're going to be patrolling the region east of the firebase at the edge of the valley. The Marines still control the firebase, so we just have to check on any buildups in the area.
Yo, do the Kongs know that shit?
Pee-wee asked.
The Kongs know everything, Johnson said.
Yeah, but do they know they moving out the first cav and putting us in there?
Two things, soldier.
Captain Stewart's voice hardened.
The first was that I've already told you that the area is secure, and the second is a question. Are you saying that the first cav are better soldiers than we are?
Fucking A right,
Pee-wee said. Captain Stewart's face turned whiter as he went over to Pee-wee.
Where the hell is your pride, soldier?
In Chicago, sir. Can I go get it?
Chapter 21. Captain Stewart put Jamal back into medical again. Pee-wee said that he did it just so that Jamal could serve him coffee anytime he wanted him to. With Sergeant Dongan gone, the squad was down to 7 guys again. Gearhart was commanding our squad and 2 others. The other squads were down to 5 men each.
You guys want to switch squads so they're all equal?
He asked.
If you don't, you'll probably be out more than the others.
We don't want to switch, sir,
Monaco said.
That goes for all of us,
Pee-wee said.
You talking for the squad now, Pee-wee?
Gearhart was cleaning his piece.
Yeah,
Pee-wee nodded.
I guess so.
Gearhart wanted to combine the other 2 squads, but they wouldn't let him do it. They said that we had to have so many squads in the field, even if it was only on paper. Brunner got a bad case of hemorrhoids. Gearhart wanted to send him to Chulai, but his time was short, and he wanted to stay.
Gearhart told me and Johnson that Brunner wanted to make Sergeant First Class.
Captain going to give it to him?
Johnson asked.
Could be,
Gearhart said.
Sucker get through a calendar, you ought to give it to him,
Johnson said.
I didn't think you liked him,
Gearhart said.
You gotta like a man make it through a whole calendar over here,
Johnson said. Things were quiet for a few days, even boring. We heard all kinds of stories about how we were beating back the North Vietnamese.
Somebody better send them a telegram so they know about it,
Pee-wee said. From what I heard from guys from other outfits, I thought we were winning too, but that it was going to be a long time before it was over. We played Pity Pat and Dirty Hearts every day. Then Monaco came up with a new game. He found some paper and put down the names of all the movie stars and singers he could think of. Then he passed them around and we played for them. That didn't last long. Wallowick won Mary Wells from Pee-wee and Pee-wee wouldn't give her up. Wallowick called Pee-wee a welcher.
A what?
Pee-wee threw down his cards.
You're a welcher,
Wallowick said.
How you spell that? And you're dumb, too,
Wallowick added.
Perry, how you spell it?
W-E-L-C-H-E-R, I said. It means you don't pay your debts.
What else it mean?
I didn't know if it meant anything else. That's when Pee-wee said he was going to HQ Hooch, where they kept a dictionary.
If they got anything in there about race, I'm going to come back here and shove a grenade up your ass.
Pee-wee stormed out of our hooch. Brunner was shaking his head.
Guy's a moron, he said.
Suppose it does have another meaning,
Wallowick said.
Then you got a grenade up your butt,
Johnson said. Wallowick left the hooch and went looking for a dictionary so he would know if he was going to have to look out for Pee-wee. I found Pee-wee drinking a soda behind the water tank.
You find a dictionary?
I asked.
Yeah, but I still ain't giving up Mary Wells.
That night, though, Mary Wells mysteriously disappeared from under Pee-wee's pillow. Sunday. The chaplain came around and asked if we wanted to come to non-denominational services. We said we would all be at the services. Only me, Wallowick, and Pee-wee went. It was good. The chaplain said nice things. He asked God to bless all the guys that had been killed and wounded and to protect all of us. We sang a hymn and ended the service holding hands and sang the 23rd Psalm. It made me feel good. I went back to our hooch and hit the nets. Ramsey Lewis was on the radio and I really got into it. I could almost imagine being home. The squad had just got some new barrels for the 60s and two new M79s. They were sitting around a tin can full of carbon tet, cleaning the cosmoline off the weapons. The whole hooch smelled of the carbon tet, and the guys were getting a little giddy.
Hey, y'all hear about the dudes collecting ears from dead Kongs and wearing them around their necks?
Monaco asked.
That's rough stuff, Lobel said.
It ain't nothing to mess with a Kong once he dead,
Johnson said.
You cut the mother's ears off while he's still alive and kicking. Then you're doing something.
And what you gonna say to Mr. Kong when he catch your ass with them damn ears?
Pee-wee said.
Excuse me, Mr. Kong, I just taken these here ears to the lost and found.
I don't know.
Monaco sighted down the 60 barrel.
You gotta be like the Kong to get him.
They just selling wolf tickets to themselves, Johnson said. They see them ears around their necks and tell themselves they ain't scared.
You ain't scared over here, you a fool, Pee-wee said. Ain't that right, Perry?
You guys better open the hooch door and let some of those carbon tet fumes out before we're all high, I said.
That's why they give us carbon tet, Lobel said. To get high.
I wanted to get up and open the hooch door myself, but just then Brunner came in. As soon as we saw him whipping out his notebook, we knew we were going on patrol.
There was some activity down near a stream about 4 kilometers away,
Brunner said.
We're going to check it out to make sure that no Charlies are slipping through.
What stream?
Monaco asked.
The Songnagu River, Brunner said.
Pee-wee had been drinking a Coke. He started with a fit of laughter and snorted the Coke out through his nose and all down the front of his t-shirt. He started laughing and trying to wipe the snot off his chin at the same time.
Is he high?
Brunner put on his pissed-off face.
No, he ain't high, Johnson said. Go on with what you got to say, man.
Brunner shot Johnson a look and went on talking about how intelligence had got wind of heavier-than-usual traffic near the stream. Pee-wee kept